Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Professor Noura Erekat speaking at Princeton University on March 26, 2026, in a talk titled Exit and Exception. It was the Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture given in honor of the public intellectual and literary critic Edward W. Said, who was a Princeton grad and who taught in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia University from 1963 until 2003. Noura Erekat is professor of Africana Studies and Criminal Justice at Rutgers University, Newark, and the author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Thank you so much to Princeton University, especially to the folks that made this possible, to Valerie, to Professor Zahid Chowdhury, to the friends who are here, it is a miracle for us to be together, like Professor Rana Berekat and Professor Nadresh Al-Hub Kavorkian. What an honor to all be in a room. I don't think any of us really realize the magnitude of what it means to gather across militarized borders that intend to keep us apart, and especially to do this in the audience of Khalto Maryam, if I may, and Najla Saeed. Thank you so much. This is very much an honor to be speaking in the legacy of Professor Edward Said, a legacy that is resoundingly loud and poignant in this moment, in the shadows of an ongoing genocide and a war of aggression against Iran, blared in civilizational tones, intended to save the West yet again from Islam. His trilogy, Orientalism, the Question of Palestine, and Covering Islam, together demonstrate how narratives can facilitate the most sadistic evils, how occlusions, omissions, censorship, victim blaming, fear mongering, and passive voices can make possible decades of war making across Western Asia and its peoples. And I would add, across American prisons, which are in fact dungeons, as well as our colonial geography, including Cuba, from where I just returned, as well as Puerto Rico. I don't know that any critical scholar ever wants to be right. They'd much rather that the salt of this earth prevail over the conglomerate storytellers and the gatekeepers standing at the fronts of these ivory towers. But Professor Said is still right about how discourse, literature, and racism shape the world and our relationship to one another in it. What a humbling opportunity to add to this body of work, especially to the 18-year-old version of myself, who Max met, who couldn't afford a $12 ticket to come hear Professor Said speak at the Berkeley Theater, where he was doing an event for KPFA Radio and the Middle East Children's Alliance. Here, a shout out also to Barbara Lubin. May she rest in peace and power. I ushered that event as a volunteer so that I can have a seat at the event and then rush to the stage with my hardcover copy of The Question of Palestine so that I can get it signed. And I want to admit to you that at the time that I got it signed, I hadn't read the book, and not for a lack, I know. But I knew the title, right? That's how we read. But it wasn't for a lack of trying. And it could have been for all sorts of reasons, English as a second language, not sufficient secondary school education. But by the time I was a freshman, I wasn't ready to absorb it. It would be years before I would understand it and incorporate it and come to appreciate it to the fullest. But I already had appreciated him and what he meant to me as a young Palestinian in his audience. And that was magnified when I saw him again in one of my favorite encounters at an Al-Awda rally in New York in 2002 on the steps of a water fountain, where he was speaking to the people and with the people. And in that image, it was my first time of seeing a scholar activist before that very moniker would be levied against me and my comrades some decade and a half later as an insult, rather than as the greatest badge of honor. Originally for this lecture, and in his honor, I planned on discussing this new work, Confronting Zionism out with Haymarket. Shout out to Tony and to Brekna here for helping to bring that into the world. But it was really difficult to stick to that project when witnessing what's happening in the world, when watching in broad daylight the kidnapping of a sitting head of state to almost no protest at the UN, to watching the siege on Cuba tighten because now there was no lifeline from the Bolivarian Republic, to watching a war of aggression launched on a sovereign Iran where none of the talking points could be used. And it really brought into focus the irrelevance of international law and the irrelevance of the United Nations when it did have an opportunity to say anything in the Security Council about the war of aggression. They condemned Iran for its attacks on US military bases and surrounding Gulf states. And so for that reason, I switched topics. And so I'm sharing thoughts with you, crude thoughts, about the relationship between what we're seeing as becoming a new world order and the seeds of it that had been planted in Gaza. And if you don't like it, you can blame Professor Chowdhury, who encouraged me to do this. And if you do like it, you can thank him for encouraging me to do it. All right. On day 733 of genocide, the supposed ceasefire agreement went into effect that slowed the aerial bombardment of a besieged people subject to starvation, whose means for survival, necessary for survival, had been systematically destroyed. Since then, Israel has killed nearly 700 Palestinians, including 32 who were bombed in their makeshift tents, and babies who are still freezing to death, and panicked mamas who have carried their children on their shoulders as rainfall flood their living spaces. While the Rafah crossing has finally been opened, aid is only trickling in, and Israel has banned 37 international aid organizations. The state continues to hold 9,000 Palestinians hostage, including Dr. Hussam Abu Safiyeh, in conditions where Palestinians are subject to food and sleep deprivation, sexual abuse, and other forms of torture. This is to say nothing of the expanding settler takeovers inflicted in the West Bank, where the state began destroying the UNRWA building in Jerusalem, and where settlers went on a rampage to burn homes and attack Palestinians to commemorate Holocaust Remembrance Day. Apologists have insisted that the systematic destruction of Palestinians would cease if only the hostages and military captives would be returned. Aside from the shameless attempt to transform genocide into a hostage crisis, the present is the reminder, if anyone here needed one, that this framework was never valid. The genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza has been the cruelest phase of the ongoing Nakba, a sustained structure of removal and dispossession with the intent to replace the land's indigenous peoples with settlers. Israelis have repeatedly told us as much in their promise to complete the Nakba, in their promise and their actual practice of targeting children who may grow up and have the audacity to fight for their liberation. Yet there remains an obstinate refusal to contend with Zionism, even among our best allies. An obstinate refusal to contend with Zionism, which is the animating ideology of genocide, based on the twin pillars of genocidal expansion and territorial consolidation, which exists and structures Palestinian lives from the river to the sea. We must understand these forms of destruction as one and the same. In 1975, a third world majority at the UN declared this ideology, quote, a threat to world peace, along with colonialism, neocolonialism, occupation, apartheid, and racial discrimination in all its forms, in General Assembly Resolution 3379. But rather than combat this enduring threat, which we see is setting the world on fire, today's diplomatic community has enabled and emboldened it in its adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2803, which endorsed Trump's 20-point plan. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio hailed this plan as an American achievement in stark contrast to the United Nations, which, quote, has no answers and played virtually no role. It could not solve the war in Gaza, he laments before the 2026 Munich Security Conference, unlike the United States, which, quote, freed the captives from barbarians and brought about a fragile truce. Rubio deliberately elides how the United States ensured this multilateral failure. The U.S. imposed Security Council Resolution 2803 by duress. By duress. Atop a ruin of the international legal order it helped to destroy. For 2 years, the Biden and Trump administrations together systematically undermined legal institutions, tribunals, and norms, including 6 vetoes at the UN Security Council, admonishment and disregard of the ICJ's provisional measures to prevent genocide, criticizing the ICJ ruling on Israel's unlawful presence in the West Bank and Gaza as a hindrance to a negotiated settlement, and U.S. sanctions imposed on anyone aiding the International Criminal Court case, including the ICC prosecutor Karim Khan, including the UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese, including the 3 Palestinian human rights organizations which were the first to submit a petition to the ICC in November 2023, Al-Haq Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Trump's ability to impose this plan is predicated on the U.S.'s steady and systematic gutting of international legal institutions, a reminder that there is no way to destroy the Palestinian people without destroying the guardrails in place meant to protect us all. As for the content of 2803, the terms of the agreement are a series of illegalities that promise only a tighter siege and a more sophisticated occupation featuring U.S. presence, not only in the traditional provision of impunity, weapons, finance for Israel, but physically in the colonial invasion dubbed the International Stabilization Force. The rest of the agreement is filled with deliberate ambiguities and glaring omissions, including no lines on withdrawal, no timetable of withdrawal, no mention of the Palestinian right to self-determination, no accountability for the perpetrators of a genocide. The Trump plan continues longstanding U.S. policy that both ensures Israel's military superiority and places the Palestinian question beyond multilateral reach. In effect, rather than combat Zionism and Nakba as structures of oppression, the West continues to frame Palestinians as the problem to be resolved either through engagement, domination, or outright genocide. Jared Kushner's presentation at Davos, together with leaked documents, only corroborates these facts. The Gaza Reconstitution Economic Acceleration and Transformation Plan, another horrible acronym, GREAT, is emblematic of violent settler fantasies that seek to supplant indigenous worlds with colonial ones. To do this, it will create 3 zones: economic, industrial, and residential. The residential plans are modern-day refugee camps intended to reduce refugees merely to their physical bodies. They can work, they can sleep, they can eat, but they have no dreams of agency and do not have the ability to shape their worlds or forge a collective future, and certainly do not constitute a juridical people with the right to self-determination, as Kushner repeatedly and deliberately referred to Palestinians as, quote, people of Gaza and Gazans. In other words, they are not presented as a polity, but as incidental remainders. Much like in 1917, when the Balfour Declaration recognized that 90% of Palestine's population existed as a physical fact, but denied as a political one, the Gaza Reconstruction Plan recognizes that nearly 2 million Palestinians have survived genocide, while some 10,000 members of their families are buried under the rubble, but it reduces these precious lives to bodies to be managed. Palestinians will be forced to register in the camps, be subject to biometric surveillance, and be compelled to use cryptocurrency not attached to any Federal Reserve, but instead regulated by their colonial overseers. Around them entrepreneurs, and vultures of capitalism will build industries over a crime scene of crushed bodies yet to be excavated and properly buried. Quote, if suspected human remains or cultural artifacts are discovered, all work in the immediate area must cease immediately, the area must be secured, and the contracting officer must be notified immediately for direction, reads the human remains protocol of the construction plan for a 5,000 military base in the south of Gaza. Business industries will benefit the looters in an age-old tradition of colonial theft, what journalist Sharif Abdel Qaddous has aptly described as a theme park of dispossession. U.S. President Donald Trump has reduced the site of the world's most vile indecencies to a real estate venture. It's all about location, he insists. The billionaire head of the private equity firm Apollo Global Management, Mark Rowan, concurs, the coastline alone is $50 billion of value. On a conservative basis, it just needs to be unlocked and financed. Notably, Rowan is also a trustee at the University of Pennsylvania. Behind much of the university's crackdown on its faculty and students, and was the singular driver, or one of the foremost drivers, forcing the resignation of President Liz McGill in December 2023. Today, Mark Rowan continues his service as a member of the Board of Peace, the body established to oversee the reconstruction of Gaza. Endorsed by Security Council 2803, the Board of Peace, I'm going to call it now BOP, was not born out of a treaty negotiated by states, nor customary law reflective of state practice, but by unilateral imposition. Its chairman, U.S. President Donald Trump, is self-appointed, has no measure of accountability, and can only be removed by a unanimous vote that can be vetoed. It is a business deal where participation is contingent on a U.S. invitation and the ability to pay a membership fee of $1 billion for permanent membership. The BOP model, built to bypass a flawed but arguably salvageable multilateral system, is based on the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the short-lived organization established to deliver food to a deliberately starving and starved, people. The architects of the GHF insisted that traditional humanitarian relief was enriching Hamas, and based on yet another unsubstantiated racist talking point, the US and Israeli governments, together with private equity firms and security contractors, established a privatized model for distributing humanitarian aid. The project, as you have seen and witnessed, was disastrous. Not only weaponizing food to further concentrate Palestinians in the south of Gaza, but also becoming a sadistic death trap where the risk of starvation can only be averted at the risk of death. Maria del Mar Logroño Narbona, vice chair of the EuroMENA initiative, highlights that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, like the BOP, privatizes public services in the name of efficiency and defines the primary problem, quote, not as political obstruction or violations of international law, but as poor management. In the name of efficiency, both the GHF and the BOP privatize humanitarian mandates by bypassing collectively established norms, be that the delivery of life-saving aid or accountability for genocide or the right of a people to self-determination. That workaround is not merely an unfortunate consequence, but is precisely the point. This is an exit from international legal norms and governance. The exit model is being built in Palestine, but is intended for the rest of the world.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Professor Noura Erekat speaking at Princeton University on March 26, 2026, in a talk titled Exit and Exception. It was the Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture given in honor of the public intellectual and literary critic Edward W. Said, who was a Princeton grad and who taught in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia University from 1963 until 2003. Noura Erekat is professor of Africana Studies and Criminal Justice at Rutgers University, Newark, and the author of Justice for Some, law and the question of Palestine.
Note that the BOP charter makes no mention of Gaza. Its first article defines it as, quote, an international organization that seeks to promote stability, restore dependable and lawful governance, and secure enduring peace in areas affected or threatened by conflict. Its mandate has no temporal or geographic limitation, and Trump's chairmanship does not expire with his tenure as president, even if he served a third term, or a fourth, or however many. But it doesn't expire. As Mandy Turner has pointed out, unlike the Coalitional Provision Authority, CPA, established to manage Iraq after the U.S.'s illegal invasion and occupation, the BOP is not recognized as an occupying power, nor is it subject to occupation law. But rather, because of Security Council authorization, it now has its own international legal personality. It has the power to enter into treaties, enough even to enter into the Abraham Accords. The United Nations created its own competition and possibly its own demise. The Board of Peace aims to privatize multilateral systems in the name of efficiency and nimbleness, where law is optional at best. So-called peace will not be achieved by peoples, nations, and heads of states, but instead by invitation-only membership in an exclusive club where aggressors can more effectively evade accountability for atrocity crimes. Not only does this seek to bypass the UN, it may ultimately seek to make it irrelevant. Recalling his Munich address, Secretary Rubio declares that the UN failed, not just in Gaza, but also in Ukraine, and Tehran, and Venezuela, and it is also a threat to national sovereignty. Rubio shares, while the United States does not want to dismantle global institutions or the old order, they do want to rebuild it. Based on what we already know and what we can gather from the players involved in the BOP, as well as the GHF, they're interchangeable, they're moving between both, that reconstruction effort is likely to be a series of governance structures that the world can pick and choose from. A model of exit long mapped out by libertarians, market radicals, and today, our anarcho-capitalists. In his 1962 book, Capitalism and Freedom, Milton Friedman, American Nobel laureate in economics, defined political freedom as the absence of coercion of a man by his fellow men. He would expand on this by highlighting the incompatibility of political and economic freedom, meaning a democratic order that demands that the state provide education, healthcare, as well as a minimum wage and labor codes, for an example, is an infringement on the rights of corporations recognized as individuals under U.S. law and international law. Friedman's ideas were emblematic of the Mont Pelerin Society, a global intellectual network founded by Friedrich Hayek in 1947 to advance free market ideas against the rising threat of socialism and other forms of state regulation. Among his many ideas, Hayek believed that morality and solidarity were unique to small groups and could not be scaled to regional and global orders. Instead, those orders were best left managed by markets and abstract institutions. In Crack-Up Capitalism, historian Quinn Slobodian deftly traces how these neoliberal economists responded to the problem of state planning by promoting escape from popular democracy in the form of liberated zones, a remedy based on secession rather than conquest. The idea is that these zones of exception with different laws and often no democratic oversight can ultimately influence the surrounding territory to shape national economies and ultimately challenge the logic of the nation state itself. Slobodian highlights that the rise of the nation state has coincided with the rise of liberated zones and constitutes a bid to reshape sovereignty. Most often, we associate sovereignty with popular sovereignty and people, national sovereignty. This is reimagining it as a privatized good. The most prominent example is the economic free trade zone, a geographic area carved out of a country subject to unique taxes, regulations, and laws, and thus exempt from state regulation. This can also exist on a much grander scale. For example, think about Dubai in the United Arab Emirates, where an authoritarian regime manages the country like a corporation to attract global capital, is constituted of many free trade zones with varying legal regimes, and depends on migrant labor with limited rights and absolutely no political freedom. Noteworthy failed historical examples of liberated zones include Siske, a black homeland, or a Bantustan, established in South Africa in 1981, where libertarians tried to supplant state-run apartheid with privatized apartheid. Siske was the seed for a Swiss solution for South Africa, a series of cantons where South Africans choose for themselves where to live, with whom, under what laws, featuring across the board privatized land and education and a very weak federal government. Indeed, among its first acts of government, Siske privatized common lands and offered tax holidays for foreign investors. Slobodian highlights that Siske was a libertarian experiment that would work as a kind of zone, quote, inviting in foreign capital while encouraging voluntary segregation from below instead of mandatory segregation from above. Though Siske ultimately failed, thanks to the ANC and brave indigenous South Africans who sacrificed their life and their freedom and who continue to pay that price, though that project failed, liberated zones have proliferated and advanced. One of the most notorious examples today is Prospera Roatan in Honduras, the modern charter city. Honduras introduced zones for employment and economic development, also known as ZEDs, in 2010. In 2017, a U.S. company applied to establish a ZED on Roatan, a Caribbean island under Honduran sovereignty. After initial approval, global investors expanded their territory through large-scale purchases, growing their holding in Prospera from 4.7 acres to 1,000 acres today. Prospera has become a site of experimentation for investors interested in abolishing the state. The island, however, functions like a state within a state, where it makes its own laws, is run by a private entity, has its own arbitration mechanisms outside of the Honduran judicial system. Notably, it's also a site of a lot of bio-experimentations that would be illegal anywhere, where humans are trying to blend in with machines, basically, what would be considered unethical anywhere, but not in Prospera Roatan, which is creating its own set of laws. Peter Thiel is among Prospera's most significant investors. After making a fortune in PayPal and seeking to evade taxes in 2009, Thiel declared that freedom and democracy were no longer compatible, taking Friedman's warnings to its very logical end. He insisted that the great task for libertarians is to find an escape from politics in all its forms. Prospera is one such escape. Thiel is the co-founder of Palantir Technologies, which has a permanent desk at the U.S.-led Civil Military Coordination Center to track food delivery and distribution aid to Gaza. Palantir has also helped with the outright destruction of Gaza and the Palestinian people, as documented by UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese in her June 2025 report. The relationship between tech entrepreneurs and Zionism, however, exceeds both ideological commitment to Israel as well as market logic of war profiteering. Balaji Srinivasan, another significant investor in Prospera, who worked for the cryptocurrency platform Coinbase and venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, is a self-avowed tech Zionist. Rather than capture state power, Srinivasan has a vision for a network state where tech-aligned societies who meet each other, the millions of people who meet each other across social media and groups and whatnot, all gather together to buy a piece of land and engage in what he describes as a reverse diaspora. He explains that this begins with a clear leader, an integrated cryptocurrency, a definite purpose, a sense of national consciousness, and a plan to crowdfund territory. The clear leader is the founding influencer who organizes the online community that eventually buys land in the physical world. Upon settlement, the tech-aligned society builds their own utopia, including culture, social life, and the economy, like bio-experimentation. Most importantly, the legal systems exist outside of the nation-state model and constitute an exception with the potential of building sufficient power to earn diplomatic recognition and ultimately reshape the laws of the world. Srinivasan's vision has been adopted by other techno-fascists like Dryden Brown, the 29-year-old American who co-founded Proxies for the explicit purpose of establishing digital nations. His company is invested in by Thiel, by Elon Musk, and the grandson of Milton Friedman. Brown attempted to buy Greenland before the Trump administration tried to seize it. He explains that Greenland is the border. If humanity wants to build a colony on Mars, we have to train in Greenland. Though Zionists have taken issue with Balaji's invocation of Zionism because it's removed from the political and historical context of Zionist thought, the resonance of acquiring territory for the purpose of ingathering a self-selecting group and reverse diaspora living under exceptional governance and regulation is quite vivid. Pioneering Zionists did not seek to be an exception. To the contrary, they sought to establish a Jewish colony in Palestine for the purpose of eliminating their difference as a racialized other, marked as exogenous from European societies, and thus, as told by Shirin Say-Eli and Max Eyal, to finally earn acceptance within Europe. Israel's Declaration of Independence explicitly reaches for legal sanction in its invocation of the Balfour Declaration as well as General Assembly Resolution 181. Nonetheless, the Zionist project has been characterized by a structural form of exception in law since its adoption as British imperial policy in 1917. The Balfour Declaration, later incorporated verbatim into the preambular text of the Palestine Mandate, distinguished Palestine from all other Class A mandates provisionally recognized as independent, unlike other Class A mandates where mandatory powers had a duty to shepherd the native populations to self-determination. In the Palestine Mandate, the British mandatory power created a duty through its own legislative efforts to establish a Jewish national home. It was this exception that enabled the British to evade their duties under Article 20 and 22 of the League of Nations mandate. And in fact, when the British government was confronted about this in the UN Special Committee on Palestine, they justified their violations because of, quote, the sui generis nature of the Palestine mandate. Sui generis in Latin means unlike any other, and as a legal concept, refers to a unique fact pattern to which no other precedent or analogy can be applied. I've argued that rather than be a site of lawlessness, a sui generis condition constitutes the justification for the creation of new law where advocates insist that no applicable law exists. Think about laws of war can't regulate the war on terror, this is beyond its reach, blah, blah, blah. They justify creating new laws, and we have Guantanamo for 20-some years. Zionism, an occupation of the West Bank in Gaza, for example, is sui generis, thus exempting it from legal adherence to occupation law. Palestinian resistance to Israeli racial discrimination and alien occupation is neither a civilian riot, nor a national insurgency, nor a national liberation war, but is a sui generis condition affording Israel the right to use lethal force against a people that has no right to fight back. After the 2005 withdrawal, Gaza is neither independent nor occupied, but is a sui generis hostile entity subject to unique legal regulation, a legal regime that privileges a global jury and affords preferential citizenship is not apartheid, but rather sui generis form of Jewish self-determination. And most recently, the destruction of the Palestinian people in Gaza is not genocide, but a sui generis instance of self-defense. John Reynolds and I argue that this structural exception in this forthcoming project confronting Zionism is an inspiration to many racial supremacists who believe that they have a privileged right to survival, even as others perish, what Naomi Klein and Astra Taylor would describe as supremacist survivalism. They share a common anxiety and aspiration. The anxiety is that demographic threats, along with progressive politics, will make them a minority at existential risk. And the aspiration is to continue to dominate in the name of national sovereignty. Zionists have been the most successful at claiming the status of permanent victimhood towards these ends because of the real history of racial subjugation and genocide against Jews. The fact that prevailing material conditions have rarely undermined Zionist claims of insecurity, even at the height of Israel's genocide of Palestinians, has offered a legitimating framework for the racial anxieties and sovereign aspirations of otherwise dominant groups. So here, think of Richard Spencer, a leader of the alt-right and the neo-fascist movement here in the United States, who said as much when he exalted the 2018 Israeli nation state law and said Israel is the model for the future of European sovereignty. Think also of Afrikaners, who after the dismantlement of apartheid have either converted to Judaism or because of their Judaism have settled in Palestine in order to maintain their place at the height of racial apex. Anarcho-capitalists like Thiel and Srinivasan are borrowing from this model to insist on their right to live on their own terms with their own chosen community to the potential detriment of others. While there may appear to be a contradiction between the libertarian push for exit and the insistence on domination, they are reconciled through a civilizational logic. The claims to exit exceeds the abstracting hands of the free market. Elon Musk, who is a lodestar among the anarcho-capitalists, who used his proximity to the Trump administration to engage in a slash-and-burn campaign of federal government jobs, benefits, and life-saving public goods, also known as DOGE. Musk, who hails from an Afrikaner family, laments that the fundamental weakness of Western civilization is empathy, and that declining birth rates pose an existential risk to the West. He has long railed against South African anti-white racism, an accusation that reached its apogee in the summer 2025 when the Trump administration welcomed 59 refugees fleeing, quote, white genocide in South Africa as it suspended its asylum program for nearly all other asylees globally. Musk and the Trump administration were directly responding to the South Africa's efforts to expropriate lands for a public purpose. The law was a very meager attempt to address the maldistribution of land where white South Africans, who constitute 8% of the population and who acquired that land through over 3.5 centuries of settlement in South Africa, continue to own to this day 70% of all farmland and agricultural holdings, 3 decades after the fall of apartheid. In its transition to democracy, the African National Congress had exchanged its claims to land and other economic rights for political equality. The proposed land reform bills aims to rectify this outstanding harm and yet was admonished as racist and genocidal from Washington. While private property among anarcho-capitalists is a supreme value, the right of ownership remains contingent. The Gaza Reconstruction Plan, for example, explicitly denies the common ownership of the land by the Palestinian people and proposes to compensate private landowners in Gaza by giving them 1 digital token for the right to build on their land. In 2025, the Heritage Foundation made an even bolder claim that Gaza is one of the very few pieces of land not under sovereignty of any nation, a status known as terra nullius in international law, invoking the settler colonial logic that facilitated the dispossession of indigenous people and the supplanting of their sovereignty across the Americas and Australia. Here, think about the doctrine of discovery. I see 2 of my students from Race, International Law, and Empire. Here, think about the doctrine of discovery. The 19th century US Supreme Court judicial rule in Johnson versus McIntosh that established that Native peoples in the Americas had a right to occupancy on the land, but not a right to title of their land. That right belonged exclusively to the colonial powers that claimed it first. By the way, this is the cornerstone. If you ever go to law school in the United States, that's the cornerstone of any property law class you'll take. But it's not taught as an affront and a violence. It's taught as the foundation of how we understand property.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Professor Noura Erekat speaking at Princeton University on March 26, 2026, in a talk titled Exit and Exception.
There's a stark civilizational logic at play among the anarcho-capitalists who see themselves engaged in frontier wars. As Zahid Chaudhry has pointed out, billionaires see apocalypse as the new frontier, and I'm suggesting that it may not just be for corporate profit, right, like disaster capitalism, in the words of Naomi Klein, but where they can establish new and exceptional legal regimes. Indications of this are already apparent in southern Lebanon, where Israeli targeting has displaced 1 million people and promises more destruction, where Bezalel Smotrich wants to push the Israeli non-border to the Litani River. The displacement may also be a precursor to what has been leaked as the Trump economic zone, stretching from Jebel Sheikh to Shab'a and Na'ura, where the United States would like to establish logistics hubs and global shipping routes to in the place of Lebanese sovereignty. Perhaps no one captures the entwinement of Western civilizational supremacy and the bid for exit from a unified global order like Secretary Rubio. During that same Munich address, I encourage you to read it. It's kind of hilarious and dystopian at once. But here's the funny part. Marco Rubio is Cuban-American, but not in Munich. In Munich, he identifies as Spanish and a descendant of Europe, and the United States as a child of Europe. And there, he insists that Americans and Europeans are part of one civilization, Western civilization. We are bound, here he continues, we are bound to one another by the deepest bonds that nations could share, forged by centuries of shared history, Christian faith, culture, heritage, language, ancestries, and the sacrifices our forefathers made together for the common civilization to which we have fallen heir. Western civilization's high watermark spanned 5 centuries between 1492 and 1945. Rubio explains that that's when missionaries and soldiers settled new continents and built vast empires, and its downfall, 1945, coincided with the rise of anti-colonial uprisings and socialist revolutions. To regain their glory, Europe and the United States must now unite to build, quote, a new Western century, featuring commercial space travel, Western supply chains, and significantly, a unified effort to compete for market share in the economies of the global South. If anyone is familiar, think 1884 Berlin Conference to divide up the African continent. Here they want to divide up the global South for their markets. To accomplish these goals, Rubio entreats the audience, the United States and Europe must work together to build a global order featuring global institutions that do not threaten their national interests. What he means is they need new global orders where they can create their own laws, not subject to anything known as a common humanity. And the seed for that is likely the Board of Peace in Gaza. So it may seem like I'm narrating, talk about uncomfortable, right? Yeah, this is not fun talk. It may seem like I'm narrating some sci-fi film or a far-fetched conspiracy theory, which, by the way, they were right, it turns out. Indeed, private sovereignty is advancing steadily, even as some national sovereignties have yet to reach their full potential, as in Cuba, or while others are still preempted from being realized at all, as among the Palestinians. The question is, where do we go from here? How does this insight shape our resistance? Though that exact plan evades me, I do know that our work must centrally include Palestine, the site of destruction of the last vestiges of an international legal order, as well as arguably the most significant manifestation of exit and exception from that order. The battle for and against Zionist ideology must be understood as a battle for a collective future. If Israel embodies the model of supremacist survivalism predicated on the racist denial of Palestinian humanity and the insistence on the supremacy of Jewish life, then therein lies the most challenging front of our efforts to insist that any future worth leaving for our children must recognize our collective whole, all of us or none of us. Salvaging the potential of a global order must be achieved through boldly rejecting claims to exception and insisting first and foremost on accountability for genocide. First and foremost, this big problem that we're facing actually begins, and the struggle for it is at our very fingertips in all the work that you are already doing and that we are doing together. In the histories that are being written, in the narratives that you're creating, in the protests that you're taking on, in the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns that you are leading, in the articles that you are writing, in the laws that you are disobeying, everything that you are doing to the end of achieving accountability for genocide is the work necessary to salvage us from this dystopian future. And should you be tired at any point, I wanted you to see this picture of Hussam Ishbat, and to all Palestinians who taught us to never give up and to never surrender. Even in death, Palestinians implored us to keep on. Hussam Ishbat is the 23-year-old Palestinian journalist who documented his own people's genocide for 2 years before being assassinated 1 year and 2 days ago when he was attacked in a clearly marked press vehicle by a missile. He left us with one dying wish. I ask you now, do not stop speaking about Gaza. Do not let the world look away. Keep fighting, keep telling our stories until Palestine is free. And should we doubt ourselves, then recall the words of Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who asked us, how many times must we start from the beginning? We survived much death. We defeated forgetfulness, and you said to me, we survived, but do not triumph. I said to you, survival is the prey's potential triumph over the predator. Palestinians have survived against all odds, over a century of imperial collusion, advanced weapons technology, and absolute impunity. And they continue to survive. We too must survive over and over again and struggle until victory for a world big, abundant, and kind enough for us all. Thank you. Yeah, I think the reason we look to Iran is because Iran, unlike, you know, any other state, is actually confronting U.S. empire. I mean, obviously, South Africa is also confronting U.S. empire as it goes to the ICJ. But here, Iran was, as the Omani foreign minister said, they were forced into this confrontation, and they were ready. As Iranian scholars have repeatedly told us, Iran has been preparing for this for the past 4 decades. So they're ready. That's why they can withstand decapitation. That's why the IRGC is deeply embedded. That's why they actually can quickly have a new sort of leadership and are not subject to this tenuous uprising that we were told that there was an indigenous uprising that was going to overturn the government. But it's actually there's a far deeper root socially. As far as the Strait of Hormuz, it is in Iran's interest to actually undermine a global economy, the very same global economy that has placed it under debilitating sanctions. So as far as they're concerned, to see this destruction and the stress that's being inflicted is to its advantage. So here we see another form of, you know, destruction that's actually productive in that sense. We also see that they're achieving one of their other military goals, which is to demonstrate to the Gulf states who have increasingly aligned and come under a U.S. sphere of influence that U.S. security pacts are actually not meaningful. And that, through the direct targeting of U.S. military bases harbored in those countries, where the U.S., rather than protect them, has diverted their interceptors to protect Israel. And we saw it before this moment, when Iran attacked Saudi oil refineries in June 2025, and when Israel attacked the mediators in Qatar last fall. And the U.S. then did nothing. So Iran is also standing to benefit from creating a wedge from this alliance that has, in fact, I mean, for anybody in this room, we would not be in this place today if there wasn't such a complete and absolute co-optation of Arab authoritarian regimes by the United States, where the only time that we saw them using any of their firepower were to shoot down Iranian missiles that were targeting Tel Aviv, but never using any of that firepower to protect Palestinians from genocide, who could at any moment use their leverage in negotiating with the Trump administration when they awarded the Trump administration $1.2 trillion as well as a private jet for Trump's own use, didn't even use that to leverage the access of the delivery of food. So there is something to be said about, and here to really understand that it would be, and I didn't obviously wrote this in a few weeks, so couldn't get into this, but there's something to be said about the UAE and KSA investment in Jared Kushner's personal firms and investment firms. They are standing to benefit from this new model, one that they, I think, are okay with. The fact that the Al-Aqsa Mosque, even if they don't care about an Arab nationalism, but even in their Muslim identity, didn't protect access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan.
for the first time in 57 years speaks volumes. So Iranian targeting of these bases to diminish the reliance on the U.S., these are all things that are actually, yes, there's potential here. If we see a shift and a pivot, there's so much here, but let me just focus on one thing. I want to emphasize, I know that after watching the horrors of genocide, we tend to see what's happening as genocide model is being applied, the double tap, the targeting of hospitals. But I also want to remind us that this preceded the genocide, that these Israeli methods of warfare have far preceded genocide. And especially when it comes to Iran, I think a paradigmatic example would be the Iran-Iraq war and the provision and the support for Saddam Hussein against Iran, and even to think about the invasion of Lebanon in 1982 as another moment and a model. And so the only thing, but what we see in Gaza is two things. We see it scaled up to we've never seen it on that scale before, precisely because of impunity. And now we see it recognized as that because we were watching it. We were watching it. And going back to Edward Said, yeah, in 1982, what he writes for us and describes as the permission to narrate is that the most difficult thing to get across to Western audiences was that no matter what Israel did, it would not be understood as the aggressor, because the audience and the readers in the West could not imagine and conjure that there was a Palestinian homeland that was usurped and that could be defended. And so just going back, just that what we're witnessing now far, far precedes the past 3 years. You know, when we talk about indigenous is not a stationary category. People weren't indigenous before colonial invasion. They just were. Africans weren't black before their kidnapping and their transformation into property. They were just whoever they were. So I just want us to really critically examine what we mean by indigenous, right? Because that would get us into this really unhelpful who was there first as a definition of indigenous, as opposed to who existed at the time of colonial invasion. So under that definition, Armenians, like the Afro-descendant, you know, Palestinians and the others who identified as Arabs, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, atheist, and otherwise, are all indigenous. And so what happens to them is the same thing that happens to all Palestinians. They're treated indistinctly as far as the settler state is concerned. Their presence continues to threaten and weaken the claims of Zionist settler sovereignty. The same way that the presence of any nation, indigenous nations, on these lands, be they Piscataway and farther north, Mohawk and lower south, Lenape, that their presence continues to threaten American settler sovereignty. So what happens to them is a singular process and a singular future. It's in what I would describe as a Palestinian future. All right. What about the question on pro-Israel lobby? Great question. You all must have been paying attention to the primaries in Illinois. All right. So in the primaries of Illinois, AIPAC couldn't run its campaigns. Under AIPAC, they had to create new organizations like the Women for a New Democracy. I forget the exact name. They also didn't, none of their ads did they run campaigns where they even mentioned Israel. It was the same thing how they primaried Cori Bush out of her seat in St. Louis when they ran Wesley Ball against her. They never went after her for her position on Palestine, but that's precisely what they were doing. And in the process, they put in the very DA who wouldn't prosecute Darren Wilson for the murder of Michael Brown. So their work to undermine a strong champion for Palestine was also undermining a strong champion for Black liberation. So here we see the entwinement as being very clear. And this tactic of shifting, AIPAC took credit for the victory, even though they didn't put their name on it. And the way they did that is the same way when the World Zionist Organization in the United States was challenged for being a foreign agent that should be registered as a foreign agent under FARA, basically said, okay, we'll become AIPAC. So the limitations of how we struggle. Now, I will say that the victory here is making Israel and AIPAC such a lightning rod that Cory Booker wants to distance himself from AIPAC. So that, I think that's a victory that we can continue to build on and should. The question you're asking is, how do we outmaneuver them? as they maneuver in this way.
And so that's where the work of solidarity really needs to happen, and strengthening measures of solidarity. I think, unfortunately, what we saw during the genocide was somehow Black liberation and Palestinian liberation being at odds. And the height of that was captured in the 2024 elections. And somehow that our futures are mutually exclusive and the safety for our peoples are mutually exclusive. And that was a failure of movement. And it demonstrated the limitations of the work that we had done really from 2012 to 2020 between the occupation of the Florida State Capitol building to protest the murder of Trayvon Martin to the uprisings in 2020, the height of Black uprisings after the murder of George Floyd. And during that time, we saw a flourishing of Black Palestine solidarity. Unfortunately, we didn't do enough of the political education to understand it. As much as many of us tried to explain, this isn't an identity politics, this isn't about being Black and Palestinian, there's a bunch of black Islamophobes, and there's a bunch of Palestinian, you know, anti-Black racists. But this is a political position, not an identity position. And it's an anti-imperial position to understand that state violence has two faces all at once. And it goes back to a Black radical tradition that understood that the fate of Black people in the United States to liberate themselves from the boot of white supremacy was in alignment with a global South fighting off imperialism, so that the, you know, Black Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee would be aligned with the PLO and the SWAPO and the ANC and the FLN. And so we're still there, right? We're still there. Our history is still the future. But I think that's the work. And it's not cute, right? It's not, you don't get credit for it. You're not going to post it on Instagram. It's not going to happen. But that's the work of us really studying these histories and understanding why it is that we need to be aligned. And especially, you know, I say this as a Palestinian for my community, Arab Americans have to make a decision. You know, as much as we go through and suffer, we also have the choice of being on the white side of the color line once we get to the United States. It's also being mindful that we have to choose to be on a Black side of a color line, which is real. And, you know, the idea that there is, you know, there's your a PEP, a progressive, except for Palestine, there's also a POP, which is progressive only on Palestine. So this work really goes both ways. I think that the 2024 elections exacerbated this to the max, where we couldn't have that discussion anymore. And now one of us had to suffer more. But that's not true. That's not true. And I think that our solidarity now, this internationalism, I think there's a beautiful thing about the internationalism in the opposition to U.S. war making in Iran, siege on Cuba, the usurpation of sovereignty in Venezuela and so on, and the genocide in Palestine is also restructuring an internationalism that can animate that. All right, thank you so much.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. This episode was Professor Noura Erekat speaking at Princeton University on March 26, 2026, in a talk titled Exit and Exception. It was the Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture given in honor of the public intellectual and literary critic Edward W. Said, who was a Princeton grad and who taught in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia University from 1963 until 2003. Noura Erekat is professor of Africana Studies and Criminal Justice at Rutgers University, Newark, and the author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.